even idealized, in our weight loss-centric quick fix society. Salad dressing on the side? But of course. Starting each day with a green juice? Hashtag health goals. Fasting after 7 p.m.? Everybody's doing it. You'd be hard-pressed to find someone who does not engage in some form of disordered eating, says Sarah Adler, PSYD, a clinical associate psychiatry and behavioral professor at Stanford Medicine, Stanford University, and founder of WAVE, a mental health coaching platform. What's tricky is that these behaviors are so subjective. Take overeating. Most days, it can be considered a form of disordered eating, but on Thanksgiving, it's a national pastime. Or maybe you skip the mashed potatoes because you can't stand their mealy texture, not because you're avoiding carbs at all costs. Eating is a very subjective and cultural experience, so it can be difficult to figure out when a behavior is disordered and when it is actually a response to something you've been conditioned to do, says Adler. Another wrinkle is that for some people, disordered eating can play a part in developing an eating disorder, like anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating. And if you're thinking that you've aged out of the risk group for eating disorders, not so fast. While the illness is most common in female teens and young adults, a study published by the Journal of the North American Menopause Society shows that a woman's risk of developing an eating disorder may increase around menopause, possibly because midlife can bring a new wave of body image dissatisfaction. All the more reason why it's important to be aware of disordered eating. Here's how to recognize the signs and get help. The clinical difference. A key difference between disordered eating and eating disorders is that the latter have a clinical diagnosis. An eating disorder is classified by the DSM-5, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition. The big book that tells us what a psychiatric disorder is and what it isn't, and has to meet a specific set of symptoms and severity, says Adler. Although disordered eating can have a lot of the same symptoms, it doesn't reach the same level of severity. Frequency can also distinguish the two conditions. Eating disorder symptoms are typically present for a minimum of 3 months and occur persistently, such as at least once a week, says Kimberly Dennis, MD, Chief Medical Officer of SunCloud Health in Illinois and board member of the Eating Disorders Coalition. Disordered eating can also occur on a regular basis, but it may also be an infrequent or even one-off event. To complicate matters, if someone is engaging in a handful of disordered eating behaviors, they may actually have an eating disorder, says Adler. You need a clinician to make that diagnosis. The social difference. While we can all agree that eating disorders should not be encouraged or, worse, glorified, disordered eating behaviors are touted everywhere. On most social media sites, algorithms and monitoring are in place to reduce eating disorder-related content, even if they're insufficient. But endless groups and hashtags exist to help women find support for their next diet or health kick. With the pervasiveness of weight stigma and diet culture in this country, there's a mentality that you have to eat a specific weight to be healthy, says Dennis. Because of this, many jump on trends that wear a health halo, only to find themselves in a complicated relationship with food. A lot of people who don't have eating disorders spend a great deal of time thinking about dieting, trying diets, or going to doctors for help with weight loss, says Dennis. Certain examples of disordered eating wave a giant red flag. Sipping bone broth every day for lunch comes to mind. But disordered eating is often considered healthy eating, as in following a diet that requires cutting out bad foods and focusing on good ones. See the Whole 30 diet, clean eating, and keto, to name a few. To complicate matters, these ways of eating can trigger additional disordered eating behaviors if you don't get enough calories, or find yourself longing for a cheat day. Restrictive diets can lead to feelings of hunger and deprivation, which often result in cravings, says Adler. And those cravings can cause overeating behaviors that then lead to negative feelings like guilt and shame. The treatment difference. An important distinction between eating disorders and disordered eating is that people with eating disorders should seek medical care. Without treatment, serious physical and mental health complications can occur, including cardiac arrest, permanent loss of bone mass, and malnutrition. Treatment of disordered eating is, no surprise, more ambiguous. It isn't automatically nutritionally or physically harmful, but it could be tied to an underlying issue like anxiety, depression, stress, or poor body image. And since research shows that dieting is a risk factor for developing an eating disorder, keeping tabs on how you engage with and feel about food can help prevent disordered eating from tipping into something more serious. Not everyone with disordered eating behaviors will need treatment, but if you notice that your eating is interfering with your life, maybe you've started skipping out on dinners with friends, that's a sign that you might benefit from outside help. The focus of treatment for disordered eating is often similar to eating disorders treatment, just at a lower intensity, says Dennis. For some people, that might mean seeing a therapist to suss out whether disordered eating could be a coping mechanism for anxiety. Others may benefit from practicing body neutrality, where they focus on what the body can do and how to take care of it rather than its appearance. Support for disordered eating is available through licensed professionals trained in eating disorders, as well as through helplines like the National Eating Disorders Association and National Association of Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorders. With expert care, you can work on shifting your mindset around food and developing less restrictive ways of eating. This article is in Relationships. Why I Finally Forgave My Estranged Father. The author of the memoir Almost Brown reveals how she became estranged from her father and what brought them back together after so many years apart. My father loves restaurants with white tablecloths, white-haired waiters in bow ties, and leather-bound menus the size of the Ten Commandments. He likes lobster thermidor and filet mignon. As Thurston Howell III on Blake Carrington might enjoy these fusty delicacies after a long day of counting their millions. And so we're out for dinner at his favorite steakhouse at an outdoor foretop in the courtyard. Dining out is one of our favorite things to do together, despite the fact that for 20 years we didn't talk at all. Not sporadically, not begrudgingly. In all that time, we didn't exchange a single word. My father is an 86-year-old Indian man. He's a compact person, even more so in senior citizenship, but he makes up for this with his wardrobe excess. Tonight, he's wearing a silk shirt and a brass-buttoned blazer with a purple pocket square, plus an assortment of gold jewelry. It's over the top for a casual supper. But he pulls it off the way people with flamboyant style win the day by owning it 100%. My dad is a retired physician, and despite having taken the Hippocratic Oath, he may be responsible for shortening the lives of countless food and beverage professionals throughout his dining career. He does not want to be introduced to his server by name. He cares not one iota about the cheese's life story, nor the Holstein that produced the milk. I've seen him send back entrees, coffees, bottles of wine, often for no discernible reason, other than it was not what he expected, or it arrived at the wrong time, or was in the wrong kind of vessel. For some reason, the good people of this establishment let him get away with it all. He's been coming here for many years and has grown a friendship with the owners. He's like family, they tell me almost every time I'm here. But he has a family, I think, or had one anyway. Does anyone really need a reason to fall out with one's relations? Family can be forgiven for its dysfunction, I think. The real wonder is that we function at all. It's the biological proximity, the enforced togetherness. Kids are born too different from their genetic precursors or too alike. A mirror, a a clash of sameness. On the parental side, it's the expectations, the obligation, the crushing weight of keeping the little people alive. The intensity is hot and dangerous, like the slopes of a molten volcano, like hell. My parents met in the 60s in London. They were both in med school. My dad was a brown, turban-wearing immigrant from a former colony. And my mother was English and as white as a porcelain teacup. The world wasn't exactly ready to embrace interracial love, and their romance basically blew up the family tree. It resulted in my dad's disownment, a lot of immigration paperwork, 3 beige kids, and eventually a move to upstate New York, where they started all over again. They had many things in common, including a profession and abiding love of British things, tea and marmalade and table manners. Most of all, they shared us, their children, along with self-imposed exile. But their relationship, you could say, was compromised from the start. My dad was blustery and temperamental as a younger man, allergic to the indignities of housekeeping and child-rearing, tragic with money, and not averse to corporal punishment when it came to his kids. Some of this was the way he'd been raised, informed by patriarchal customs that whiffed of the ancestral village, but had no place in a modern, egalitarian home. He was no normal Western dad as I'd come to appreciate them from sitcom TV. He didn't do rumpled shirts nor affectionately oblivious parenting. He demanded exceptionalism from his brood, especially when it came to academic performance. Only we'd become naturalized kids, grass-stained and junk food addicted, more interested in the unfettered pleasures of the American outdoors than doing our geometry homework. We failed him often. I was scared to death of him much of my childhood. This was slowly replaced by a smoldering adolescent fury, an emotion I inherited from him, naturally. His parenting style was oppressive, according to my perception. It sought to preserve my reputational innocence, if not innocence itself, by forcing my burgeoning womanhood back into the bottle. I'd once run amok with the kids from my neighborhood, and we'd roamed the streets, the trails through the woods, but once I became a teenager, all of that ended, as if puberty was a punishment unto itself. My father became suspicious of my autonomy, of boys, my girlfriends, the dark, and so I became an indoor daughter, consigned to homework and chores, held back from the freedoms he'd brought us to this country to enjoy. When I was 16, my parents' marriage dissolved. It was a long time coming. Most of all for my long-suffering mother, who had indulged my father's idiosyncrasies with the patience of a blighted saint. Take your pick of the usual reasons. It all came down to betrayal, as it does so often for millions of lovers who transition from pillow talk to communicating through their lawyers. My parents divorced, not for any standout reason except one. They'd come from worlds apart. After that, I blamed my dad for crashing our family security, as shaky as it had been. I couldn't be anywhere near him without getting lost in a whiteout of resentment. But I didn't want to live that way. The feeling was like rust for the soul. I didn't have a language to explain it back then, but I sensed I couldn't go forward. Couldn't build anything for myself with my father in my life. But mostly, I felt his post-divorce absence once my mother gained custody. The dad I detested but still desperately missed for the person he might have been. In the 2 decades that followed, I never once reached out to him, and he never called me either. Estrangement. That's the common term for what happens to parents and children when the bonds between them dissolve and they discontinue knowing one another. According to research, parent-child estrangement is not at all uncommon, even if nobody wants to talk about it. The break is more likely to be initiated by the child, who is more often disconnected from a father. Surprisingly, to me anyway, most of us reconcile, even if it takes half a lifetime, but I don't really care for the word estrangement. It's too big and blunt. I don't like forgiveness either. It's flat, too small, to describe an odyssey that unfolded for me not in a moment, but with stages, detours, and backtracks. When I was a teenager, I said I'd rather light my own hair on fire than allow my father back into my life. But fate laughs at certainty, It abides no bombastic forevers. In my 20s, forgiveness came for me with its hands in its pockets, its head bent low. When acquaintances asked about my dad, I felt shame. We were nothing, I was forced to admit, as their pity passed over me like the flaps of a car wash. As a result of our distance, I was also cut off from the parental side of my family, Friends sometimes confessed that they thought of me as an orphan. In my 30s, forgiveness came for me at weddings and funerals. I watched stern, serious fathers melt down in tears as they walked their daughters down the aisle. I attended memorials for men who'd been loved by hundreds of friends and relations, who eulogized them in open grief. They'd be missed on the daily for decades to come. Forgiveness came for me like an itch beneath the bandage. I'd made mistakes of my own by the time I approached middle age. I'd learned how easy it was to fail with spectacular abandon. I came to see my dad as a flawed, well-meaning human, born of flawed, well-meaning parents, just trying to make a go of it in a world in which much was beyond his control. If my willingness had arrived, the opportunity took a little longer. My dad and I eventually reconnected at a family wedding to which both had been invited. He appeared before me, regally dressed as always, but reduced, diffused by age. I was taller than he remembered, more oblong in the midline, with graying roots, a little less lean and mean. We were familiar strangers. In the ensuing months, we rekindled a tentative friendship that looked nothing at all like how we used to be. We reminisced about our family years while militantly avoiding certain topics, chiefly the reason for our estrangement in the first place. We started fresh, with the hovering awareness that we could revert with one misstep. My dad and I rediscovered our shared fondness for dressing up and dining out. He let me tease his eccentricities now that I was free from their consequences. He was a kinder, happier person in his twilight years, tenderized by some hard-learned lessons. I saw that our days were numbered. He continues to drive me nuts in his ways, old and new. Whenever I venture out for dinner with him, it's a thrill, an event charged with danger and surprise. I never know what's going to happen. Often, after we are seated, I disappear to the restroom in hopes of intercepting our server at the wait station. Here, I apologize in advance for the occupational hell that is about to unfold, and I promise to compensate them for their woes if such a thing is possible. When it's time to relinquish our table, my father will insist on greasing our waiter's palm, or he'll leave a few bills behind on the tray next to his untouched ovation mint. Perhaps we stand outside on the wet pavement beneath an umbrella, waiting for my spouse to retrieve the jacket he's left behind, expressly for the purpose of revising the tip. My father will say he had the best time. The restaurant, the food, the company, it was perfect. This kernel of memory will build into a burnished reminiscence, which he'll retell for many months. Why I do this for him, this symphony of secret workarounds, I'm never fully convinced until this one moment at the end that makes him so happy. In our new routine, I play the role of his daughter, but I'm more like his partner in crime. I laugh at his jokes and indulge his grumpy moods. I refuse to get on his case for staying up late and smoking cigars or drinking Coke for breakfast or backing his car into bollards. He refuses to take the facts of aging or even his own mortality lying down. In this campaign to squeeze every drop from life, I'm his willing accomplice. I didn't choose forgiveness. I'm not sure I'd recommend it even now, since the package does not guarantee forgetting, let alone apologies. But what's family without a little adventure, a little chaos? What's life without the collateral benefits of changing one's mind?
Article edited due to time.
In Wellness, this article is 5 kinds of grief society doesn't acknowledge. It's time to honor these heartbreaking experiences and learn ways to heal. When I was 19, I was diagnosed with an incurable degenerative retinal disease, which was about as fun as it sounds. After meeting with a succession of capable but cold specialists, I found Dr. Jacobson, whose compassion was as uncommon as his brilliance. He had to administer the same awful tests his colleagues had, involving electrodes on eyeballs, but unlike the rest, he offered to play my favorite music while he did it. What helped more than the music was the knowledge that this doctor thought of me as a person rather than a collection of damaged cells. I've seen him every year for more than 2 decades. Over the years, we've talked about Philly cheesesteaks and our mutual love of Shakespeare and his revolutionary research, which I was confident would unlock a way to help my failing vision. And then, a few weeks ago, I found out he'd died. As I reeled from this news, I struggled to communicate the nature of the loss to those around me. I knew it didn't make a lot of sense. I didn't know him well. I didn't know the names of his kids or how he liked his eggs cooked. But I'd loved him all the same. I'd trusted him to take care of my failing eyes. But in the process, he'd taken care of far more than just that. So I sobbed as I read and reread the announcement of his death, and when my daughter asked why I was crying, I told her, my doctor died, and he was really, really important to me. I don't know if she understood, but she didn't need to. She put her arms around me, and it helped. There are as many kinds of grief as there are people who grieve, and these sorrows don't only happen after a loved one dies. Our lives are full of other kinds of crushing losses. The unsuccessful fertility treatments you can't afford to repeat. The novel you spent years writing that never got published, leaving a beloved community that you called home. Grief is the pain that arises when a future we once counted on is no longer available to us, says Marissa Renee Lee, grief advocate and author of Grief is Love. Whether it is because of the death of someone you hold dear, a divorce, an infertility diagnosis, or an unexpected disability. But because society often doesn't recognize these instances of grief, people don't believe they're entitled to the sorrow they experience, says psychotherapist Megan Devine, author of It's Okay That You're Not Okay. And that, spoiler alert, is a problem. It's not in our best interest to pretend things don't hurt when they hurt, says Devine. If we don't find a way to process the feelings, to name them, they're going to come out sideways, find other ways to speak. The first order of business, then, is let the grief speak. To that end, we're amplifying 6 under-discussed sources of sorrow that demand to be felt and shared. 1, a failed IVF treatment. I have a friend, Toby, who struggled for years to get pregnant. She did 8 rounds of IVF, and every failed cycle was like a death, she said, to the point that her husband wanted to stop trying because it was so painful to watch her suffer so intensely. She said it was like a bomb going off in her, and yet the grief was all but invisible. She didn't talk about it with people besides her closest friends. It's what she regrets most about the experience, because it robbed her of the support system she desperately needed. Eventually, she had a baby, who is now a delightfully precocious preschooler. But though my friend is now a mom, she says infertility is a part of her personal identity forever. It shaped who she is. The media represents grief as a short-lived emotional experience, which won't disrupt your life for very long if you do it right, says Devine. But grief is not a linear logical process. There's no finish line. 2, creative failure. The movie you spent 2 years editing that didn't go anywhere. The series of oil paintings stacked up against your wall that have never been shown. Anyone who has ever seriously attempted a creative enterprise has experienced some form of creative failure, and the sense of loss you feel is proportional to the amount of blood, sweat, and tears you poured into it. What makes it even tougher is this. To make art, you have to remove your protective armor and bare your heart and soul, which makes the pain of rejection all the more acute. This kind of loss falls under the category of death of a dream, except that there's nothing wispy or whimsical about this dream. This is a goal you've devoted countless hours and countless dollars to achieve. These losses are real and valid and devastating in their own way, says Devine. Her advice for dealing with them? Don't underestimate the power of acknowledgement. Our gut impulse is to minimize it, she says, but just the act of saying ouch is a really powerful action step. A kid leaves the nest. I expected the tears that came at the airport after I left my son in a badly lit dorm room 1,016 miles from home. What I didn't expect was the tears that came at other times, when I passed his favorite food truck and thought of picking him up a taco al pastor, when I found the capo for his guitar under the couch. My friend Lisa says the sadness would spring up out of nowhere when Jeopardy came on and she'd hear a question she knew her son would know the answer to. Another friend describes it not so much as sadness, but as the feeling of forgetting something, a weird sensation of something's always been missing. In moments like this, Divine says, distraction can be helpful. It often gets a bad rap, but distraction can be a healthy coping tool, she says, explaining that it only becomes problematic when we use it on a continual basis in order to keep dodging uncomfortable emotions. It's not a long-term strategy, says Divine, but when your emotions feel too overwhelming, it's a way to give yourself a break. Loss of a beloved neighborhood. There are all kinds of reasons people lose their neighborhoods, from natural disasters to gentrification. Sometimes the neighborhood is still there, only you're not in it. This kind of displacement can trigger a complicated flood of feeling, fed by many tributaries of missing. You miss the people you've left behind, not just the friends, but the grumpy crossing guard who helped shepherd your little ones to school, the spacey barista, the proprietor of the pizza place that wasn't even that good but stayed open late. Often what you missed most is who you were when you lived there. I have a friend, Kate, who is living in a tiny New York City apartment that started to feel less like a shoebox and more like a shoe as she grew her family. When she moved into a bigger apartment in another area, she mourned that chapter of her life she was closing by leaving the place where so many important things had happened to her. Whenever she passes through, it hits her, what she describes as a longing, a nostalgia for a time in her life that's passed. Divine's advice for moments like these is to gaze within. We often look for external guidance to tell us how to deal with challenging things in our lives, she says, but there's a lot you already know. One helpful exercise is to interview your grief. Take two pens of different colors. One color is you, and the other is your grief. Ask your grief, what do you want me to know? What do you need from me? And see what unspools. You may not always find an answer through this dialogue, says Divine, but you'll always get a response which can help you through. The end of travel soccer. When your kid is involved in all-consuming activity like travel soccer or a youth chorus or a competitive jazz team, you get sucked in too. You cheer and applaud at endless games and recitals and competitions, no matter how crappy the weather or boring the performance. You befriend the other families, even when you think you have nothing in common. Your heart breaks with your child's at every disappointment and soars at every victory. And you schlep. You schlep with cleats and jazz shoes and coral robes. And then suddenly it's over. Kids start different schools and peel off. You realize you've watched your child make her last goal or do her last pirouette because, no, she isn't going pro. The more space the activity took up in your life, the bigger a hole it leaves when, poof, it's gone. There's no perfect-sized plug for the hole, says Lee, but treating yourself with compassion will assuage the ache. Giving yourself permission to grieve and treating yourself with kindness are some of the only things that really do help, says Lee. Divine agrees. Everyday life is full of grief that we don't call grief, and all of it deserves love and care and attention and support. This is from Oprah's Insiders. Oprah on the preciousness of life. Hello again, Oprah Insiders. You know, every day that we get to breathe in and out is such a gift, and living it to the utmost, which is unique to every one of us, comes down to how you approach every day, what your outlook is, what your attitude is. Recently, I came across a New York Times article about Dr. Roland Griffiths, who is a world-renowned scientist and the founding director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research. Dr. Griffiths has dedicated his life over 50 years to studying the human mind, and has now been diagnosed with stage 4 terminal cancer. For him, the preciousness and mystery of life are paramount as he approaches death with a sense of openness and acceptance. It's truly inspiring to be able to talk to somebody who knows that they are dying. I was so taken by Dr. Griffiths that I wanted him to join me during a recent Life You Want class taping. Now he has a very special perspective as he knows he is dying. We all are, of course, but his passing is imminent, so he's embraced this reality after going through a variety of emotions, which is only human, feeling depressed about it, feeling anxiety about it, resentment about it, to get to this point. He realized that inhabiting those states would be torture for him, so what did he do? After being awakened to that preciousness of life, he said he leaned into gratitude. It's natural to want to avoid thinking about our mortality. You get fearful and sadness creeps in. But looking at life and death through the illuminating lens of gratitude is game-changing. I've been saying this for years and years and years. Being able to practice it in the most challenging times, that's what changes us, Dr. Griffith says. He says he continues to experience wonder, not fear. And he stays in a deep state of curiosity, exploring what he calls the benevolent mystery of what it is to exist. I love that. The benevolent mystery of what it is to exist. He wants to share what he's learned with us so that we can lean into this treasure source for living before we get a terminal diagnosis. So valuable. In Lifestyle, this article is coming soon. Oprah and Dr. Peter Attia get real about living better for longer. On June 21st, join Oprah and Peter Attia, MD, for a surprising and informative conversation about how to craft a longer, healthier roadmap for your life. If you are over the age of 40 and even remotely interested in your health, the algorithm is very likely serving you up a steady stream of supplements, meal plans, and exercise regimens that all promise to stave off the inevitable. Enter the term longevity, which seems to be on everybody's lips these days, especially as news of life expectancy in the U.S. dropped to 76.4 years, the shortest it's been in nearly two decades. Once the province of certain Silicon Valley masters of the universe biohacking their way to immortality, living a longer, healthier life is well within everyone's reach, asserts Peter Attia, MD, author of new book, Outlive the Science and Art of Longevity. And it has little to do with going to the doctor. Longevity as a concept is really only meaningful to the extent that we are defying and avoiding all the contributors of decline, physical, cognitive, emotional, simultaneously, says Attia, who kicked off our upcoming The Life You Want class on the subject with Oprah and an audience of select Oprah Daily insiders at Oprah Daily's headquarters in New York City. This article was edited due to time. We're jumping to culture and news. Sweet Magnolias fans are freaking out after learning about this season 3 news. Your favorite ladies are back. Every once in a while, there's a show that captures our hearts and becomes our comfort show. That's exactly what happened when Netflix premiered its latest Southern drama, Sweet Magnolias. The TV series first premiered in 2020, and now it's official. We're headed back to serenity. Netflix officially announced that the hit show will be returning for a season 3. Actress Joanna Garcia Swisher, who plays Maddie Townsend, shared the exciting news with fans on Instagram with the caption, "We are back! Season 3 of Sweet Magnolias is happening!" Of course, with an announcement as major as this, fans flew to the comments section to tag their fellow Sweet Magnolias friends and share their thoughts. So happy for you and everyone on that special show. Let's go! Absolutely incredible. Fellow co-stars Brooke Elliott, Dana Sue Sullivan, and Heather Headley, Helen Decatur, also shared the news with fans on social media. All had an overwhelming response from fans ecstatic about their return. When is the Sweet Magnolias Season 3 release date? Season 2 was released in February 2022, but we have to wait a bit longer for season 3. Netflix confirmed that the 10-episode season will drop on July 20th, 2023. Who will be in the Sweet Magnolias cast for season 3? As far as we know, fans can expect the entire cast to return for the upcoming season and pick right back up from where we ended in season 2. So that means Joanna Garcia Swisher as Maddie Townsend, Brooke Elliott as Dana Sue Sullivan, and Heather Headley as Helen Decatur will definitely be on our screens. After all, that cliffhanger fans were left with deserves some answers. We've got a lot of questions, and hopefully season 3 will bring us some much-needed clarity. How to watch season 1 and 2 of Sweet Magnolias? If you need a little refresher before binging season 3, streaming Sweet Magnolias is as easy as opening the Netflix app. Both seasons are available now exclusively through the streaming service. Our next article is Big Bang Theory Fans Support Kaley Cuoco After Her Heartbreaking Personal News. The flight attendant actress remembered her late dog dump truck. Kaley Cuoco is mourning the loss of a beloved family member. In a post uploaded on Cuoco's Instagram on May 30th, the Big Bang Theory star announced the death of her pet Chihuahua dump truck, with a number of photos documenting their time together. The sad news came 2 years after the death of her dog, Norman, whom she recently honored by naming her upcoming pet brand after him alongside her Yes, Norman Productions film company. Amid sharing selfies and candids with the pup, Cuoco reflected on how special Dump Truck was to her. "A dog is the only thing on earth that loves you more than he loves himself," she captioned the pictures. "My sweetest dump truck, saying goodbye to you has deeply pierced my soul. You were with me during some of the hardest moments I've had in my life." Cuoco continued, "You brought endless joy to everyone that met you and kissed my nose when I needed it most. You were as special as it gets, and I'm so grateful we found each other. Please tell Norman I miss him every day and will cherish you both forever." As soon as the flight attendant alum shared her heartbreaking news, many of her celebrity friends sent kind words her way. "So sad. Love you, sis," former Big Bang Theory co-star Kunal Nayar wrote on Instagram. "I'm so sorry. Huge hugs to you guys," Hallmark star Lacey Chabert said. Or Chabert, C-H-A-B-E-R-T, added, "I'll miss you, Dumpy. He was such a sweet soul." Her fashion stylist and close friend Brad Goreski replied, "There weren't the only ones who reacted to the news. Many of Cuoco's followers reached out with their sympathies as well. So sorry for your loss. He was truly special. R.I.P. sweet little Dumps," one person commented. "You gave each other so much love and gave Dumpy the best life," a different follower penned. "The best boy, sending you all the love and hugs," another responded. Despite the unexpected loss, Cuoco still has a lot of love to give. She recently welcomed her daughter Matilda with boyfriend Tom Pelfrey, along with adopting a rescue dog named Miss Opal. Another article in Culture and News, fans flood Bonnie Raitt, 73, with support after the singer reveals health news. The Grammy winner canceled shows after a medical situation required surgery. Bonnie Raitt was set to kick off her tour later this month, but has been forced to postpone her dates due to a medical situation. "Bonnie has a medical situation that requires surgery to address her," team wrote via a statement. The doctors say that in order for her to heal properly, they recommend she not perform for a couple of weeks. Of course, the 73-year-old blues legend received an outpouring of well wishes. Her tour is now set to start in Dublin on June 1st. "We're sending Bonnie Raitt all of our positive thoughts for a speedy recovery." The 73-year-old blues legend was set to kick off her tour this month, but she has been forced to postpone her dates due to a medical situation. Bonnie's team updated her fans on social media, and she received an outpouring of support from her fans. The statement explains that she had to postpone several of her tour dates. "Bonnie has a medical situation that requires surgery to address. The doctors say that in order for her to heal properly, they recommend she not perform for a couple of weeks. It continues. Thankfully, Bonnie's in great hands. She was so looking forward to these shows, but we're excited to be able to resume our 2023 tour, now kicking off in Dublin, Ireland, June 1st. Thank you for your well wishes and understanding. We very much appreciate you respecting her request for privacy at this healing time. Rates fans shared their messages of support and left comments like, "Love you, Bonnie. Get better. The world needs you." And "Health and strength to the Queen of the Blues," singer Brandi Carlile wrote. "Get well soon, Bonnie. We all absolutely adore you." "Everyone is glad that you're taking care of yourself and not pushing it," actor Benjamin Bratt added. "Wishing you most well, Bonnie." In January, Rate took home the Song of the Year Grammy Award for Just Like That. She beat out the likes of Harry Styles, Lizzo, Taylor Swift, John Legend, Adele, and more. It was her 13th win out of a total 30 Grammy nominations. Hopefully, she'll be healthy and back to performing very soon. This article is Pat Sajak announces Wheel of Fortune retirement after 41 years as host. Wheel of Fortune host Pat Sajak has announced that he will retire after more than 40 years at the helm of the iconic game show. Writing on Twitter, Sajak says, "Well, the time has come. I've decided that our 41st season, which begins in September, will be my last. It's been a wonderful ride, and I'll have more to say in the coming months." He took over as host back in 1981, replacing the show's original presenter, Chuck Woolery, and overtook The Price is Right's Bob Barker as the longest serving of a game show back in 2018. Along the way, Sajak has won 3 Emmys and a Daytime Emmy Lifetime Achievement Award. The show itself has given out $250 million in prizes and still attracts 10,000 applications a year and 26 million weekly viewers. He isn't departing the show completely, however. With Sony Pictures Television's Executive Vice President Suzanne Prete, that's P-R-E-T-E, stating via BBC News, "Pat has agreed to continue as a consultant on the show for 3 years following his last year hosting. So we're thrilled to have him remaining close to the Wheel of Fortune family." No replacement host has been announced at the current time, and it's also unknown if Vanna White, who has been the co-host since 1983, will be departing as well. Wheel of Fortune isn't the only major game show to lose a long-running host in recent years, as Jeopardy had to look for a new host after Alex Trebek sadly passed away in 2020. The Big Bang Theory's Mayim Bialik and 2004's winning player Ken Jennings currently share hosting duties. Although Bialik stopped filming the latest season earlier to join the writers in striking. Meanwhile, Stephen Fry has been announced as host of the long-awaited UK version of Jeopardy. This article is Tom Holland opens up about being happy and in love with Zendaya. Tom Holland and Zendaya are far from hiding their relationship anymore, although they don't share too much about it in interviews. But while doing press for The Crowded Room, Holland offered a little insight to BuzzFeed on how happy in love he is with Zendaya. He was asked whether he has Riz, Gen Z slang for charisma, especially when flirting. "I have no Riz whatsoever. I have limited Riz," he started. "I need you to fall in love with me, really, for it to work. So long, game." Probably making a movie with each other, it definitely helps when the characters are falling in love with one another and you can sort of blur the lines a little bit. "That's kind of where my Riz is at, and you know, I'm locked up, I'm happy and love, so I've got no need for Riz." BuzzFeed noted that later in the interview, he shared a little more about his life with Zendaya and how often she messages him. "She sends him the most memes. It's nonstop," he said. "She sends me too much. It's like, I can't keep up. I delete my Instagram for days at a time. I download it to post, and then I have to check my messages, and I'll have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of things from her." This wasn't the only recent interview with Holland discussing Zendaya. He told Radio Times in an interview published on June 2nd that Zendaya was wonderful for putting up with his the crowded room haircut, along with his grappling with the role's impact off camera. In my career, I've always felt I've been very good at leaving work at work, and for the first time with the crowded room, it really did start bleeding into my personal life, he stated. And I think a large reason for that is when you make a film, it only takes 4 months, and that would be considered a long film. But The Crowded Room, it's 10 months of playing this character day in and day out. I really did find myself kind of morphing with him in certain moments, and obviously I had that crazy hairstyle. I would come home from work and I would see myself in the mirror and I would see him, he continued. So it did take a while to figure out how to put him to bed and wake Tom up and get on with my life and be myself. But I figured it out and was very happy and healthy, and also I had the bangs. Bless Zendaya, she had a lot to put up with me looking like that for 10 months. It was rough. I don't like my hair being that dark. I really like how my hair is like my mom's, kind of red. Yeah, it was tough. That was a part of the show that I don't miss for sure. This article is Stacey Abrams has a new role at Howard University. The Democratic leader's appointment will motivate students to be the change they want to see. Whether she is campaigning to become the first black governor of Georgia, with Oprah valiantly fighting for voting rights, starting organizations, or writing books, Stacey Abrams remains a pioneer in the political arena and beyond. Georgia's former House of Representatives minority leader is bringing her passion for change to Howard University, where it was recently announced that she will be inaugural Ronald W. Walters Endowed Chair for Race and Black Politics. Abrams' role will be part of a Leadership and Public Policy Center at Howard that's named after Walters, a political and activist who served as a professor and chairman of the Political Science Department at the school during his career. Her responsibilities include facilitating interdisciplinary collaborations across the university on critical issues of race and black politics, especially those issues that affect Americans of the African diaspora, hosting a series of discussions with various luminaries and more. In a statement from the hallowed HBCU, Abrams said, "I am honored to serve as the inaugural Ronald W. Walters Endowed Chair for Race and Black Politics, having had the privilege of knowing and learning from Dr. Walters," she said. "We are at an inflection point for American and international democracy, and I look forward to engaging Howard University's extraordinary students in a conversation about where they can influence, shape, and direct the critical public policy decisions we face. From my alma mater, Spelman College, I have carved out a career that allows me to weave together policy analysis, political leadership, social justice, business, environmental, entertainment, and more. Through this post, I hope to emulate Dr. Walters' diasporic lens on our world and be a part of how Howard University continues to contribute to the broader political discourse." But you don't have to be a Howard student to stay inspired by Abrams' drive. Her latest book, Rogue Justice, a Thriller, drops on May 23rd.
Article edited due to time.
On The World According to Gail King, Gail King reminds us that she is not signing off from the news anytime soon. Our editor-at-large was honored as the 39th recipient of the Walter Cronkite Award for Excellence in Journalism. Gail King was a curious storyteller long before she entered the news business. What came as part of a revelation for her was that she could make a thriving career out of her shrewd talents, and even more so, that she could be awarded for it. The CBS Mornings co-host's decades-long journey of doing what she absolutely loves, and doing it well, has earned her the honor of being chosen as the 39th recipient of the prestigious Walter Cronkite Award for Excellence in Journalism. The announcement was first made on the morning broadcast in September of last year that Gail would join the ranks of esteemed journalists, the past recipients Robin Roberts and Anderson Cooper, to be recognized in a luncheon ceremony hosted by Arizona State University, Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication on February 21st in Phoenix. The two-day trip began with a packed schedule of local visits, talks with students, and ceremonial events that all left Gail feeling a bit intimidated by Tuesday morning as she was putting the final touches on her speech. Being the modest person she is, our editor-at-large was a little uncomfortable to be the cause of such a big fuss. Gail's CBS team, friends and family, including her favorite son Will and favorite daughter Kirby, who made her way through a TSA security line for the first time in 3 years just for this, were all by her side to celebrate and ensure Gail just how worthy she is of all the fuss. She has been in the business for over 4 decades and continues to crush it, Kirby told Oprah Daily just before the luncheon, and Will noted, "This is a big, big deal. And we are so honored and so proud, and we adore her. She keeps getting better and better, and just when you think she reaches the top, she goes past it." And although Oprah couldn't travel to be there in person for the ceremony, she still found a way to share how proud she was for best friend. In a video played live, Oprah said, "I do not know of anybody more deserving of this award than you, because I do not know of another human being on the planet Earth that is more curious, more compassionate, more caring of other people's stories." "I'm still trying to wrap my head around it," Gail said on her way out of Phoenix, finally taking a moment to let the enormity of the honor sink in. "It's a big deal. Earlier this morning, someone told me, it's like your Oscar." Gail, who maintains that she doesn't do her job to get awards, had to admit that this was a biggie. Another person along the way let her know that this was going to be her best day ever after hearing the news. And to that, Gail responds, "It's definitely one of the best days of my life." "We are so proud of you, Gail. Congratulations on this well-deserved honor." Gail took a moment to share a few words of acceptance. See a few highlights from her remarks below. On her dad's influence on her love of news. "I was in 7th grade when I discovered Walter Cronkite. How? Because my dad had an unbreakable rule that we had to watch the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite at 6:30 every night as a family. That was not my idea of a good time. I thought Walter Cronkite and the news were so boring, but my dad insisted it was important to know what was going on in the world. My dad had no idea how he was preparing me. Night after night, Walter Cronkite came into the living room reporting the news, and people trusted that he was giving them the truth. My dad was one of those people. He passed away when I was a freshman in college, but I can't help thinking of him today because I know he would be so proud of this moment. A, that I even work at CBS, which was his network, and B, for him to see me standing here getting the Walter Cronkite Award for Excellence in Journalism. And I have to say, I no longer think the news is boring. Covering the news is my happy place." On how teamwork really makes the dream work. "May I just say something about my CBS Morning News team? I'm a team of producers, cameramen, editors, directors, researchers, hair and makeup. Thank you, Jesus. We are truly a tight unit. And I know my bias is showing, but I think one of the best in morning television. Just the other day, the way we work and look out for each other was on full display. Picture this. 45 minutes before airing, there is a technical issue at the Times Square studio and broadcasting. From there was not an option. And within 45 minutes, we had to move the show, the guests, and everybody to the old broadcast center. And let's just say it, it wasn't next door, and I don't know how we did it, but we pulled it off and got on the air on time. There aren't enough thank yous I could give to express my gratitude." In her speech, Gail did take special care to give some individual shout-outs to those who helped her make big strides in her career, including CBS Mornings executive producer Shauna Thomas, CBS trailblazer Susan Sarinsky, and CNN's Chris Licht, L-I-C-H-T. On why she's not going anywhere, Walter Cronkite was 65 years old when he signed off from the CBS Evening News in March of 1981. And guess what? I'm 68 years old, and I'm not even close to signing off. The big bosses, Niraja Kemlani, president and co-head of CBS News and Stations, and George Cheeks, President and CEO of CBS and Chief Content Officer, News and Sports, Paramount Plus, are always in the room where it happens because they make things happen. I want to thank them for their leadership in my employment. I am honored to have a seat at the CBS Mornings table, and retirement is the last thing on my mind, and that's the way it is, as Walter would say. We have a book recommendation, Down a Dark River by Karen Oden. One finely dressed dead girl found bound and surrounded by flowers in a small boat on the Thames strikes a curious tableau. A second and third could spark panic that our cross-pressured Scotland Yard detective Michael Coravan is determined to avoid. Unfolding in 1878, 10 years before Jack the Ripper terrorized the working women of London, and written by an authority in Victorian literature, the story probes similar territory as Hayley Rubenfeld's Ripper-inspired social history, The Five. Period and place are exceptionally well drawn, from the sights and smells of the city's most famous natural landmark to the jewelry on the elegant necks of its Mayfair residents to the secrets boundaries that rule their lives and provide the key to the killings. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.
Article edited due to time.